You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, a plan has been drafted up to end the 28-year battle between the Turks and the Kurdish rebels. We'll speak to our man in Istanbul to find out if this could be the beginning of the end of the fight. Pakistan has announced that it will press ahead with plans for a pipeline to import gas from Iran, despite the US and the West saying this will be in defiance of international sanctions. We'll hear why the Pakistanis are so defiant.
The US hasn't been able to come up with a solution for Pakistan's energy crisis, and Iran conveniently has, and they're offering it for a very discounted price. So the Pakistanis, I think, are sensing that this is really one of their only solutions at this time.
And it's good news for the music industry. It's shown its first signs of growth since 1999. We'll find out how record labels have adapted to a digital market. And in today's monologue, we ask just how much stuff infants and toddlers could possibly need.
The soothing centre. Why hold your baby when this had three seats in recline positions, six swing soothing vibration speeds, an MP3 connection, and 15 pre-recorded melodies and nature sounds? Oh, and don't forget the adjustable canopy, detachable toy, and removable play tray.
All that, plus we'll be playing some fine tunes too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up with the latest headlines with Paul Osborne.
The United States says it will increase aid to opposition groups in Syria. The White House says there'll also be more U.S. humanitarian aid for Syrians fleeing the two-year uprising against the Assad regime. The announcement follows reports that the U.S. could provide body armor, armored vehicles, and military training for opposition groups in Syria. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says they could do more to help.
We think it's very important that more of our assistance is getting to areas that have been liberated from the regime. And that's not enough. We need to help the Supreme, the Syrian Opposition Council. We need to help them to be able to deliver basic services and to protect the legitimate institutions of the state.
Mr. Kerry has also welcomed today's international talks on Iran's nuclear program. Officials from Tehran say the talks in Kazakhstan were positive. A UN human rights investigator says there should be an international inquiry into the death of a Palestinian prisoner in a jail in Israel. Israeli officials say Arafat Jaradat died after suffering a heart attack a week after being arrested for throwing stones at Israeli cars in the West Bank. Palestinian officials claim he died after being tortured. His death led to riots in which six people were injured. Swiss police say the man behind a shooting at a factory in the country had worked there for 10 years. The 42-year-old is among three people to die at the wood processing plant in the town of Manznau, close to Lucerne. Seven people were injured, five of them seriously. Beppe Grillo, the comedian-turned-politician whose party took a significant share of the votes in Italy's election, has ruled out a coalition with the party's main, country's main centre-left group. He says he won't go into government with Pierluigi Bassani and says instead that he expects there'll be fresh elections in Italy within a year. European regulators have blocked Ryanair's third attempt to take over the rival Irish airline Aer Lingus. It's 6 years since the budget carrier first tried to acquire Aer Lingus, but the European Commission says Ryanair hasn't done enough to allay concerns that any deal would give it an effective monopoly on more than 40 routes. Competition Commissioner Joaquin Almunia says a takeover would have had a significant impact on passengers.
In the end, the most likely outcome of this transaction would have been quite simple. When flying to and from Ireland, passengers wouldn't have been able to choose between as many options as they can today, and they would have ended up paying higher fares.
Pope Benedict has admitted he's faced choppy waters during his 8 years in charge of the Roman Catholic Church. In his final general audience in St. Peter's Square, he said the papacy had been a heavy burden, saying he's aware of the gravity of his decision to resign. Tomorrow, Benedict becomes the first pope in almost 600 years to step down. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul Osborne. We'll be hearing from you in 25 minutes' time. It's 18:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London with me, Hugo MacDonald. Is one of Turkey's biggest domestic issues coming to an end? For almost three decades, the islands on the Sea of Marmara have been home to some of Turkey's most dangerous prisoners. The most famous is PKK leader and founder Abdullah Öcalan, who's spent over a decade in prison on the island of İmralı. For years, the only person regularly allowed to visit the PKK leader has been his younger brother, Mehmet, who works as a farmer in eastern Turkey. Until now. On Sunday, the justice minister approved a delegation of three Kurdish party members to the island prison to draft a peace process. The government and its Kurdish opposition are showing positive signs of willingness to end a conflict that has killed more than 40,000 people since it began in 1984. To tell us more, we're joined by Monocle's regular contributor, Caleb Lauer, who joins us live from Istanbul. Welcome, Caleb. Maybe you could start by telling us just how important these developments in the Turkish-Kurdish situation really are.
They're extremely important in the sense that everybody from the government to the Kurdish party, the party that represents Kurds in the parliament, to newspaper commenters, to even the opposition that disagrees with the process, is spending basically all their time commenting on this and trying to make sense of it for people. It is by far the most optimistic point Turkey has come to since the conflict started. So in that regard, it is as important as it could be.
And what is the likelihood, do you think, that the PKK will call a ceasefire in Kurdish New Year on the 21st of March, as Öcalan has suggested might be the case?
That's the question that the answer to that question will determine whether or not this process does have a life that people want it to have, or there are grounds for people to be as optimistic as they are. Öcalan has said that, or he has communicated the idea that a ceasefire, an official ceasefire, be called on March 21st, the Kurdish New Year. If the PKK abides by that, that indicates that they are listening to his proposal as followers listen to a leader. If there is some reservation or if there is some reason why they don't feel that they can officially declare a ceasefire on the 21st of March, that will indicate that Öcalan's leadership itself is in question. If Öcalan's leadership comes into question, that will call the whole process into question because, in a sense, the government has put, it's put its whole bet on Öcalan, that Öcalan can come through for them.
And what do we know about the power that Öcalan has still over the PKK?
Well, it's interesting. He's been in prison since 1999. He was put on trial, and the trial was broadcast on television, obviously. And at that time, people were sort of dismayed. They were thinking, is this guy working for the government? He seems so, contrite and sort of pathetic in a sense. But over time, his stature has overcome that, or his stature has grown. It's overcome the image of the prisoner in the dock. And the main recent event that has demonstrated how much power he does have was with the hunger strikes last fall. In September of 2012, about 68 or 64 Kurdish prisoners went on a hunger strike that ended up lasting almost 70 days. By the end of the hunger strike, Solidarity hunger strikers had joined the strike, and there was over 650 people on what's called a death fast in Turkey, which is you're fasting till the end, basically, and up to 10,000 other people on solidarity hunger strikes in support of these demands. The government had tried to intervene and stop them. The Kurdish party in parliament had tried to intervene to stop this. There had been pleas from all different sides of society. Öcalan declared that the hunger strike should end, and it did within 12 hours. This demonstrated to everybody, despite the fact that the hunger strikers' demands were not met, this demonstrated that Öcalan had seemingly absolute power over people who are conducting these hunger strikes, which means the PKK.
And Caleb, obviously key to the success of this process is the Turkish government passing reforms that would increase the rights of the Kurdish minority. I gather that there's no demand for Kurdish autonomy, but what reforms do you think these would be exactly?
Well, that's a key point in the sense that it's often misunderstood. The PKK and the Kurdish separatist movement started as exactly that. It was a separatist movement fighting for an independent state called Kurdistan. The PKK actually means the Kurdistan Workers' Party. So the name Kurdistan is actually in the name of the organization. Now, that has been sort of universally realized is impossible by all people in the Kurdish struggle. The way they speak, they say that in our hearts we want a state, but we know that that's impossible. Over the years, that demand for a new state had sort of come down to, or had been watered down to, we want autonomy. Now, what's interesting in the last few days is that those demands, even autonomy, have disappeared from the rhetoric. And basically, to sort of boil it down into a phrase, what the PKK wants now is a country that looks like a country that could join the European Union.
And what do you think is the reason for Öcalan's sort of slight softening of these demands and the fact that he's even willing to sort of negotiate in a more rational way?
Well, there's a few things. One is that the demands, obviously, for a state are not going to work. That requires a conflict, like a war of independence type thing. And everybody, the military, the opposition, the government, the Kurds, the PKK, Öcalan, everybody has realized that a military struggle will never end. It will never be won. It will never be lost. It will just continue. The other thing is that Öcalan has been in prison for so long that his only real contact, like you said in your introduction, are very, very few people, his lawyers, his brother. But the government is offering him a chance to become relevant or to be much more relevant than he's been. The offer of becoming relevant, a statesman, a peacemaker, has obviously, encouraged him to help the government achieve peace.
I also want to ask you, Caleb, about Erdogan. And, I mean, he's been a big supporter or pushing through giving Kurds more rights. Does he face a lot of opposition from nationalists in the country still?
Yes. His record on Kurdish rights has sort of been up and down in the sense that it seems to be quite... He plays a very complex game. When it's in his interest, he can seem very, very democratic. When it's not, he can seem very non-democratic. For example, during the hunger strike, to win favor with the nationalists, he suggested bringing back the death penalty, which was obviously a reference to Öcalan. Meanwhile, he was negotiating with Öcalan the whole time, knowing full well that he would never bring back the death penalty for Öcalan. But the need to sort of pacify the nationalist opposition to this is basically the key question. Many Turks, basically half of Turks, are fully supportive of the idea of peace. But if you look at surveys that ask how do you feel about Öcalan, or how do you feel about Öcalan getting anything that resembles a positive benefit out of this, it's nearly universal that all Turks want nothing for Öcalan. They want nothing for the PKK. They want peace, but they do not want to give anything to anybody that has killed Turkish soldiers and has caused so much bloodshed. So the question about how Erdogan is going to play this game is going to be fascinating to watch, and it could be it could be problematic. There's been a debate all week whether or not Erdogan is nationalist enough for the opposition. And in Turkey, nationalism is a very, very important thing. And if you seem like you are being not ultra-nationalist, you can also be seen as being a traitor, in a sense. It's that serious.
Well, we'll be keeping a close eye on the situation as it unfolds. Caleb Lau, our regular contributor in Istanbul, thank you very much for joining us. Coming up, we'll find out why Pakistan will press ahead with plans for a pipeline to import gas from Iran.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
It's just always going to be different, for me at least. I've never recorded an album in the same place under the same circumstances as the last record, so it's always going to be quite different.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
The main market used to be Europe, of course, United States and Japan. Now you have tens of market, very interesting, also regions. You have, of course, Russia, then you have Kazakhstan, you have so many other. It's a completely different world.
What could be greater than an hour of The Curator? Listen to it live or download it later.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
Welcome back to Midori House, live from London, where the time is 18:17. Despite pleas by the US and threats of serious consequences, the Pakistan government has gone ahead with a plan to complete its side of a gas pipeline linking the country to Iran. There are also plans for the Iranians to build an oil refinery plant in Pakistan. The US government has said publicly that if the pipeline is completed, it will risk breaking sanctions on Tehran and compromise the West's ability to put pressure on Iran, which it has long suspected of having a nuclear weapons program. Pakistan, however, is seen as having little choice. The country is suffering from a massive energy shortage, with routine blackouts a part of daily life. This past Sunday, nearly the entire country was in darkness after an energy grid was overloaded. To discuss the country's energy crisis and the potential rift with the West, Monocle's Andrew Tuck spoke with Al Jazeera's Pakistan correspondent Imtiaz Tayyab.
How bad is the energy crisis for the country?
Well, look, the energy crisis here is, in a word, horrible. I've been in Pakistan for a couple of years now, and we experience it firsthand here. It really cuts across all classes. The bottom line is Pakistan simply does not produce enough energy or is not able to buy enough energy for its country. So it needs cheaper alternatives. And frankly, the Iranians have a huge amount of energy they're struggling to get rid of, and they can send it to their neighbor, Pakistan. And that, of course, is very attractive to the Pakistanis. They, of course, want this cut-rate energy they can get from Iran. Iran has completed its side of the pipeline. All it requires is Pakistan to effectively complete its side of the pipeline. And at least some of this huge, huge, huge lack of energy that we have in this country could be solved. But as you rightly point out, the complication here is Pakistan's ally, the United States.
Now, lots of other countries who border Iran are making daily deals with the regime there and kind of getting away with it. But I guess in the case of Pakistan, the US and the West feel that they should have some kind of leverage because they give so much money to the Pakistani government. But do you think that leverage just isn't powerful enough when it comes to the government having to face what it does do about this huge energy crisis?
Well, the curious thing about the U.S.-Pakistan relationship is the notion of leverage. Yes, you're absolutely right. The United States has significant sway when it comes to Pakistan, and again, when it comes to certain amounts of money that the U.S. has given Pakistan. But on the other side of the coin, the Pakistanis also have a lot of leverage with the Americans. The Americans really want Pakistan to play a large role. Post-2014, they believe Pakistan is sort of the linchpin when it comes to some sort of peace peace between the warring factions in Afghanistan. And more to the point, they also see Pakistan as vital to keeping the region relatively stable as they draw their troops out. So it's, of course, a very complex relationship. And I think the reason we're seeing Pakistan's president, Asif Ali Zardari, who in the last few hours alone has just arrived in Tehran to meet with the Iranian leadership, ostensibly to talk about this deal, the reason he's willing to do that, and perhaps at the very least is inching towards finalizing this agreement, which would see the construction of this pipeline and this energy being passed from Iran into Pakistan, is because of that leverage. And all Islamabad needs to do really is to go to Washington and say, listen, you say you keep helping, you want to help us with our energy crisis. You're also saying that we can't get it from Iran. What are we supposed to do? And at this stage, Washington hasn't given Islamabad a good enough answer, as it were, to solve this very deep crisis when it comes to energy shortages here.
So do you imagine that there may be some realpolitik here, that you'll see the State Department huffing and puffing, but in a way allowing the Pakistanis to make this deal?
Again, it's a very delicate dance on both sides. The reality is, as I said, you know, Asif Ali Zardari is in Iran and he's there for reasons. Although the state media has said that they're there to discuss bilateral relations, everyone knows he's there to talk about this pipeline. And you're absolutely right when you say that the State Department will certainly put out its terse statements, but in terms of Pakistan receiving any major blowback, bar cosmetic blowback, I'm not convinced that Pakistan's going to face something like that, because quite simply, the U.S. hasn't been able to come up with a solution for Pakistan's energy crisis, and Iran conveniently has, and they're offering it for a very discounted price. So the Pakistanis, I think, are sensing that this is really one of their only solutions at this time, and Washington, as we've been saying, hasn't come to them with a better one.
And Imtiaz, just before we go, what's the timeline on this? When could we see the pipeline completed?
Again, it's quite ambiguous at this stage. Some believe that President Zardari will ink a deal in the next few days. But the reality is this pipeline has been called a pipe dream by many, simply because Islamabad may, at the end of the day, have cold feet because of fears of angering Washington. So, again, it's hard to say at this stage. There could be a deal in the next little while, or it could draw out for another several months. But the fundamental thing that hasn't changed here, Pakistan's energy crisis is only worsening, and as we enter the summer months, it's just going to get even worse.
That was Al Jazeera's Pakistan correspondent Imtiaz Tayeb speaking with Andrew Tuck earlier. More oil in a moment.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monaco.
18:22 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. Last November, BP received the biggest criminal fine in US history. It was part of a $4.5 billion settlement following the fatal 2010 explosion and subsequent oil spill at the site of its Deepwater Horizon oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico. This week, the civil trial has begun to determine whether the British oil giant was negligent or grossly negligent. So with two full days of the trial behind us, how are things looking for the oil giant? Joining us now is John Costonis, Professor of Law at the Louisiana State University Law Center. John, thank you very much for joining us. It seems to have been a lot of finger pointing in the first couple of days. Maybe take us through how they've panned out.
Well, there'll be a great deal more finger pointing in the next few months as well. You're dealing with the first phase of a three-phase trial. They're trying right now to determine liability as between BP, Transocean, Halliburton, and Cameron, who did the blow-up preventer. And, of course, the finger pointing is that the various parties are all saying the other guy did it, because once that liability is assigned, the next phase, this summer, will be to determine how much oil actually came from the well. And that's an important question, because there could be a potential penalty of $4,000 per barrel. And the United States government is claiming there are 5 million barrels, and BP says the number is much shorter. And then finally, next year, there'll be a trial where they'll actually fix the damages. Now, of course, whether things actually go that far, or there's a settlement before that, is anybody's guess.
There have been reports that the trial could last as long as 10 years. You've laid it out there as if it would be quite a smooth, relatively short process. What's the likelihood that it might stretch on and on and on?
Well, I mean, the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska here in the United States, that was only settled about 2 years ago. And in final terms, in terms of a final agreement on approval by the U.S. Supreme Court of the punitive damages that Exxon had to pay. And, of course, the Exxon Valdez event occurred in 1989. I hope that this one doesn't go that long. And when we talk about it, the trial won't go for 10 years, but the appeal and then the subsequent appeal could well take that long. Hopefully that won't happen.
Yeah, with any luck. I mean, it's going to be very difficult for BP to wrangle too much blame on the others, presumably, isn't it? How damaging will it be for BP's brand, though?
Well, it seems to me that much of the damage really has already occurred, hasn't it? Except this. BP entered into a settlement with over 100,000 plaintiffs in which they agreed to pay about $7.8 billion. This happened about 4 months ago. And speaking with the attorneys involved, it's pretty clear the reason why BP did that was they did not want to have come out some of the things that already are starting to come out in the present trial. And the more testimony that comes forward that suggests culpability or willfulness, negligence, or things of that kind, I think the more difficulty that BP will experience reputationally.
You mentioned things that BP would rather not come out. Is that evidence of cost-cutting over safety measures?
It would be cost-cutting. It also is just very, very poor management coordination. There's a team that has to do these wells. It's the well owner, which is BP. It's the owner of the drilling rig, which would be Transocean. It'll be the people who have to cement the hole to make sure you don't have what happened here, which would be Halliburton. And finally, the people who provide the blowout preventer in the event that the well does blow, and that would be Cameron. And one of the big issues here was the extent of coordination and effective coordination amongst the various players, with, of course, BP in the lead because these others were all contractors to BP.
And, John, I mean, BP is the principal supplier of oil to the U.S. Defense Department. What's the implication of this in the sort of relations between BP and the U.S.?
Well, you know, this is a very, very interesting question, and I can only speculate, Hugo, on this, but yes, BP is the principal supplier of oil to U.S. defense activity, number one. It also has the principal position in terms of outer continental shelf drilling off of Texas and Louisiana. And it also is a major provider of jobs. And it's also a company of an ally whom the United States feels very warmly about. So that at some point, it seems to me, it wouldn't surprise me if there were some move on the part of the U.S. government, which after all controls the Department of Justice, which is bringing the government side of this suit and seeking potentially up to $20 billion in damages. One can only speculate that at some point, if there's a serious threat to BP's own financial solvency, that this thing will not just be about oil, it will also be about diplomacy. But I'm speculating, but I kind of suspect something like that might happen.
Of course. And also, I mean, this is a small thing, but how does one determine the difference between negligence and gross negligence?
That's a great question. And, you know, your English courts have foisted that problem on American courts going back roughly 400 years. I guess that gross negligence is a lot worse than negligence. The reality, it will relate to the degree of ineffectiveness and knowledgeable ineffectiveness with respect to that very last phase that just preceded the blowout and explosion on the Transocean rig. Questions will relate to the workmanlike practices of the people in charge, to the extent to which there were prior efforts to control and coordinate that element, and basically to the degree of divergence from best practices in oil drilling activity. And ultimately, of course, a judge will have to sit there and weigh all those things and come up with a judgment.
Rather him than I. John Costonis, Professor of Law at the Louisiana State University Law Center, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. in the next half hour of the programme, we'll be asking if it's possible to move a Frank Lloyd Wright house brick by brick from New Jersey to Italy, and we'll be asking why you'd want to. We'll also find out why the music industry has cause to celebrate for the first time in 14 years. But before all that, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
The United States is promising to increase its aid to opposition groups in Syria. The White House has also said there'll be more U.S. humanitarian aid for Syrians who are fleeing the uprising against the Assad regime. The announcement follows reports in U.S. newspapers that the country is considering providing body armor, armored vehicles, and military training for opposition forces in Syria. Police in Switzerland say the man behind a shooting at a factory in the country had worked there for 10 years. The 42-year-old is among three people to die at the wood processing plant in the town of Mansnau, close to Lucerne. A UN human rights investigator has said there should be an international inquiry into the death of a Palestinian prisoner in an Israeli jail. Officials there say that Arafat Jaradat died after suffering a heart attack, but Palestinian officials say he died after being tortured. Beppe Grillo, the comedian-turned-politician whose party took a significant share of the votes in Italy's general election, says he won't go into coalition with the main centre-left grouping. He says he will not form a coalition with Pierluigi Bersani. Instead, he thinks there'll be fresh elections in Italy within a year. And Pope Benedict is preparing to step down after 8 years in charge of the Roman Catholic Church. In his final general audience in St. Peter's Square, he said he'd faced choppy waters during his 8 years and said he was well aware of the gravity of his decision to resign the papacy. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up, we'll hear how difficult it is to move a house brick by brick from New Jersey to Italy. But before that, here's an Australian band from Brisbane. This is Mitzi with Voyage, Voyage. That was Brisbane band Mitzi with Voyager, Voyager. Now, if you're lucky enough to own a house by legendary American architect Frank Lloyd Wright, it's not something you'd happily give up. But one couple, the owners of the Bachman Wilson House, built by Lloyd Wright in the 1950s in New Jersey, are going further than most to hold on to their prized home. Due to repeated flooding and the ensuing damage, the owners, Mr. and Mrs. Tarantino, are looking to move the house brick by brick to upstate New York, and possibly even to Italy. Well, to discuss if this is even possible and what the consequences might be for the stunning Lloyd Wright House, we're joined on the line now by Janet Hulsted, Executive Director of the Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy. Janet, thank you very much for joining us. Maybe you could start by giving us a little bit of background on this story and why the Tarantinos are so keen to move the house in the first place.
Well, it's a very... A very lovely Frank Lloyd Wright house, and at the Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy, we work with all the owners of Frank Lloyd Wright buildings, and we support all appropriate efforts to preserve the built work of Frank Lloyd Wright. In this particular case, this house has experienced extensive and repeated flooding. So much so that it is beginning to damage the structure itself. And so, although our position has always been that Wright buildings should remain on their original site, occasionally we've made exceptions on that, and we feel that these owners have currently taken all the measures they possibly could to find an alternative solution, but there are none. And so moving the house is a solution of last resort, which in this particular case we support.
And just to be clear, is it flooding through bad weather, or is it the site that it's built on that means that it is going to be repeatedly flooded, and really there's nothing that can be done to shore that up and sort of try and keep the foundations where they are?
Well, it is suffering more and more from increased flooding from hurricanes and bad storms, but this was exacerbated also by not just natural occurrence, but by some construction of some things that were supposed to help water management in the area, but unfortunately did not help this particular house and others in their surrounding neighborhood, and in fact made the flooding situation worse. And although they've tried to work out solutions with the local authorities, there doesn't seem to be anything that can be done at this point except to move the house in order to save it.
And there's been sort of reports that the house might be moved to upstate New York, but also maybe to Italy. What is the determining factor in this?
Well, I think at this point, since the decision has been made by the owners with the support of the Conservancy to try and move it in order to save it, it would be ideal to move it to something closer by in the region, because that's more true to the original site where the building was located, if they can find the same kind of topography and vegetation and solar orientation. But if that's not, if they can't find an owner who's willing to take on this house, a new owner, because actually they're offering it for sale to a new owner who would move it. And these owners, the current owners, are architects, and they understand what's involved with dismantling and reconstructing a house and are willing to help in that reconstruction. So if a new owner could be found in a closer kind of environment, that would be ideal. Mm-hmm. But if not, perhaps it would have to move much farther afield, and at least there is a historical connection to the area that they're looking at in Fiesole in Italy, because Wright spent some time there.
Yes, I gather. So would they ideally sort of sell it before moving it, or are they so desperate to sell it that they would sell it and then move it afterwards?
Yes, that would be part of the sale, would be the understanding that it would be moved.
And you mentioned a little bit earlier that similar incidents have happened before where the building's been deconstructed and relocated. How difficult is it actually to take a Frank Lloyd Wright building apart and then rebuild it sort of brick by brick?
Well, the more modern structures, it is possible, although, again, as I said, you know, should only be done as a last resort in order to save it. We were involved with another Wright house. This was in Oregon. That was under an immediate threat of demolition. So again, this was only a solution of the last resort after some intensive negotiations. The Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy was able to convince the owner to donate that building to us and also receive some tax considerations for that, because we're a charitable organization. And then the Conservancy negotiated with others to move it to a site that was about 25 miles away where it could be reconstructed. So it is now an open functioning house museum in Oregon at the Oregon Garden Foundation under their auspices, and is protected from further threats of demolition by a preservation easement. So it is doable. And in this case, I think because the owners who are selling the home are architects, they have a very good understanding of how this can be done. So basically, they would take the house off of its concrete slab and number the pieces and reconstruct it in a new location.
Wonderful. Well, Janet Halstead, Executive Director of the Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with music from English soul singer Laura Mvula. Stay with us.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the global pulse.
I was at a bunga bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually. and occasionally take things down a notch too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. And the guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat.
We know that he had them and we know that he'd used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
Welcome back to Midori House, where the time in London is 1844. We'll be discussing the first growth for music labels since 1999 in just a moment. But first, here's an artist tipped for big things this year. This is English soul singer Laura Mvula with Green Garden.
Take me outside, sit in the green garden. Nobody out there. I go wherever you go, wherever you take me, I'll go.
That was Laura Mvula there with Green Garden from her new album Sing to the Moon, which is released next week. It's 1847 here in London. We'll be staying on the topic of music next because for the first time since 1999, the music industry has reported a growth in sales. Last year, revenues rose by 0.3%. It's not a meteoric revival, but it's being heralded as a significant turning point for an industry that has struggled to revive in the digital era. Joining us on Midori House to talk us through the reasons for this long-awaited positive nugget of news for the music industry, and to say if we're premature in popping a cork in celebration, is Chris Cook, business editor of Complete Music Update. Chris, thank you very much for coming in. So just following on from what I said there, are we premature in getting too excited about this? Or, I mean, it is good news. 0.3% is a rise.
It is. I mean, it's better than decline, which is what the record industry has seen for the last decade and more. Although you're right, it is 0.3%. And if you look at the figures overall, the record industry is still generating 40% less now than it was in the late 1990s. So there's still a lot of decline to make back up. But I think the big record companies and the global trade body, the IFPI, who released these stats yesterday, they are definitely seeing it. This is us turning a corner. This is the end of the decline. And this is now, from this point onwards, we rise again. And I suppose it'll be interesting to see in a year's time, is this just a wobble? I mean, I don't think it is. I think that we are now going to see a persistent rise in the coming years. Although, will the record industry ever get back to where it was 15 years ago? Probably not. Mm. Although the record industry is just one part of the music industry. These stats don't include live performance. They don't include the money that can be made in the publishing rights in the songs. So it is just one bit of the picture, although the record industry is probably the highest profile part of the wider music industry.
What is the reason for this small rise? Is it just that people have managed to suddenly monetize, or not suddenly, but gradually monetized digital?
It is that, yes. It is that every year for the last 10 years, CD sales continue to decline and still do. Digital has been rising, but it's never been that the digital rise has been enough to compensate for the CD decline, whereas this time it has. And I think digital is gaining traction for various reasons. And I think a lot of the things that the optimists in the record industry have said in recent years are starting to come true. Things like there will always be a small portion of web users who will, if they can get your content for free from illegal sources, they will do so. But actually, there's more people who, if you provide them with great services that are easy to use, that seem to be fairly priced, will gladly pay you £10 a month or 79p a download. And so it has just been getting that sort of variety of services and compelling services out there. And I suppose, I think the music industry, about 5 years ago, having really sort of, you know, dug its heels in the ground and not been very good at embracing new and interesting ideas. About 5 years ago, there was a definite change of philosophy at the big record companies. I think we're now starting to reap the rewards of that.
You mentioned a little bit before that record sales is obviously a small part of the industry. Other areas are growing, though, in terms of revenue, aren't they? Like performance.
The idea, I mean, obviously, live the live sector booming has been a story that has been around for the last 10 years, and the live sector has been doing well. With the live industry, it's interesting that the live sector is doing very well at the upper end. Actually, at the grassroots end, it is still quite a struggle in a lot of countries to make those smaller gigs add up. I suppose the reason why the record industry is important in the wider mix, even though it is just one strand of the wider music business, is in terms of investing in new talent. If you're a new band and you need someone to write a check for £50,000, £100,000 to launch you as an artist, which is what most managers would agree is what you need, generally you go to record companies and it's them who write that check. And traditionally they recoup that money just by selling records, although it has to be said that that is no longer the case. They would no longer give you that money just taking ownership of your recordings. They'd certainly want to cut probably of your merchandise and your brand partnerships, which are other big growth areas in the wider music industry.
Again, you mentioned a little bit earlier about piracy sort of being on the decline. Is that just through better services being offered, or is it also that sort of the younger generations don't want to get everything for free like they did? Well, I remember when Napster launched and everybody was so thrilled and excited. Obviously not in the music industry. But do you think there's more sort of social responsibility in a digital arena than younger people today?
I suspect not. I suspect it is more that free services are now available. I mean, actually, although we talk a lot about services like Spotify and Deezer in Europe and Pandora and Rhapsody in the States, I mean, you can't underestimate the importance of YouTube as a service. And certainly with a younger demographic, you know, we think of that as being a video service. A lot of people, they stack playlists up in YouTube, they minimise the screen and they use it as a streaming music service. And of course it is free and it has lots and lots of content on there. But the record companies earn from that. Every time you play something on YouTube, through the advertising sales that they create, are giving money back to the rights owners and ultimately to the artists. So I think it probably is through just the growth of services which appeal to those younger fans who perhaps don't want to pay. And I suppose it is that finding, well, surely in the advertising space, there must be a way of still being able to earn from that. So I'm not sure it is a rapid rise of social responsibility. The labels would tell you that obviously there are new laws out there which are trying to combat piracy. And I'm sure the labels would say it's partly because of that. Again, I'm not even sure it is. I think it's just that good services are now emerging and people are choosing them.
Well, it's good news nonetheless, and we hope that it is the start of the end of woes for the music industry in general. Chris Cook, business editor of Complete Music Update, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam,
all around the world. This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. Now it's time for our daily monologue, and today we turn to Monocle producer Katie Bilboa, who thinks that baby products may have gone too far, a lesson best passed from one generation to another.
I'm not the kind of person that hangs around the baby section in out-of-town toy stores with my dad, but recently I found myself doing just that. Don't ask me why, but there we were, slowly making our way around the brightly lit aisles of a well-known mass-market children's superstore. Every row was packed from floor to ceiling with board games, plastic figures, bikes, building kits, water pistols, swords, dolls, balls, hoops, and a plethora of objects which likely bring intense joy to the world of an 8-year-old child. For me, while there were moments of nostalgia, my overriding sensation was one of nausea. The combination of intense strip lighting and a strong smell of plastic was likely a contributing factor. I was also conscious that here we were, two adults in a toy shop, without a child in sight. I should add at this point that my companion was not a quiet one. Such was the shock of the impact that 50 years of inflation have had on Lego prices, for example, this was something that could not go unnoticed. Cries of, "How much?" and "What even is that?" echoed around me. I tried to make a move away from him. Thought I'd lost him around the tricycle section, but soon enough he appeared again as I approached the buggies. A friend of mine has just given birth to her second child, so I tried to focus on the positives. We were now in the baby area. Here was a chance to think about what gift I wanted to buy her. Perhaps, among all the plastic and pink, there might be something interesting. Loudmouth, on the other hand, was in shock and keen to verbalise it. How, in less than 30 years, had the market for baby products increased so exponentially? How could a new parent possibly differentiate between what was superfluous and a necessity? I wanted the chorus of complaint to stop, but on the other hand, I was drawn to his storytelling. Beyond this angry monologue, he was actually sharing his experiences of life as a young parent. This passing of knowledge and wisdom from one generation to another felt like a ritual. And as we turned our next corner, I realised he was right. In front of us was the soothing centre. Why hold your baby when this had 3 seat and recline positions, 6 swing soothing vibration speeds, an MP3 connection, and 15 pre-recorded melodies and nature sounds? Oh, and don't forget the adjustable canopy, detachable toy, and removable play tray. At that moment, I realised that when it comes to children, less is more. I joined the chorus. What even is that? I asked, before making my way to the exit, wondering if anyone nearby stocked handcrafted wooden toys. For Monocle, I'm Katie Bilboa.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
Well, that's all we have time for today on Midori House. Thank you very much to our producer, Dawn Trump, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Edward Lucas, and our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Next up is The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove, where we'll meet a small Finnish startup company that's determined to shake up the global banking industry.
We aim to be the hub of your financial activities, but we are not ourselves offering everything. So we'd like to work with other companies to bring in their services so that you have this full sort of ecosystem around a Holvi account.
Very good indeed. And Emily Aylett will be here at 2000 hours for the Pacific shift. And in 3 hours' time, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson will be back for the Monocle Daily. Steve Broomfield will be here tomorrow with Midori House at the same time. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Goodbye.